Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2022 podcast series. This event was proudly supported by the Faculty of Arts, the University of Melbourne.
Well, I think that means the event has begun. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Michael Williams. I'm the editor of The Monthly, and I am thrilled to welcome you all to this Melbourne Writers Festival event. It is happening, of course, on Wurundjeri country. The people of the Kulin Nations, we pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and the members of their community and other communities that join us today. The voice to Parliament, the Uluru Statement from the Heart, is a reminder of the ways in which the fault lines between truth-telling, between storytelling, between acknowledgement are rich and varied. And so an acknowledgement of country isn't just a kind of generic disclaimer we do at the start of events. It's about pausing and reflecting and thinking about the context in which we're doing our work. I'm very excited to be joined by these two astonishing authors on the stage with me today, Christos Tsolkas and Sarah Winman. A big round of applause for both of them. They are, without fear of just trying to shoehorn it into the topic today, writers of great beauty in their work, and they have given comfort, stimulation, excitement, delight across many works, across many years. And it feels like an incredibly exciting opportunity to talk to them today about the business of writing about and writing beauty, particularly at a time when, I don't know if you've noticed, but outside this theatre, if you look at the world at large, things are pretty shit at the moment. Things have gone to hell in a handbasket. So the role of literature in relation to that, the role of the arts is, seems to me, a particularly kind of acute one for us to consider, whether it has a responsibility to be political, whether it has a responsibility to respond to that environment into which it's created, but most of all, what the responsibility of beauty is. Is beauty just a distraction? Is it a solace? Or is it in many ways an antidote to the ills of the world, as we said? We will discuss all of this and more today. But before we go any further, I know from having had the chance to talk to him in this room once before, Christos Tsolkas, you have a long association with this beautiful theatre we're in.
Yes. Michael said that, asked about that. And my strongest memory, and I was explaining this to Sarah just a moment ago, was being a young kid and my father taking my brother and I to see Superman, the 1970s Christopher Reeves version. And we were a little bit late. The film hadn't started. It was the trailers and walking up, and it was a packed house and the lights were glimmering. And I thought I was walking up to paradise. I just remember being so excited. Because it is such a beautiful building. But then when Michael asked, I also, and I think this is important, because Sarah and I just realised we really love film.
Yeah. That's it.
Underneath this theatre, there was the Australia Twin, much smaller spaces, some of you will remember. And around that age, or a little, I must have been a bit older, I went and saw the Taviani brothers' Padre Padroni, which was a film about a peasant boy who's which is really my father and my mother's life. And it was beautiful in a completely different way and shocking. There's a scene in it where the boy gets terrified by a snake, and he's only a little boy, and his father kills the snake and then whips him with it. Whew. And I'm talking about it because it's one of the most beautiful films that I've seen, but within the beauty there's also great horror and ugliness. And I think, having read Sarah's work, you get that.
No, I totally get that.
So cinema is important to you as well, Sarah?
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, I think it's just probably my first love. We were sort of saying before, you know, this opened up as, you know, is it books or cinema? And I think cinema nudges it a little bit. There is nothing like the excitement of sitting there while the ads go on and it's just about to start. But my early memories are probably not where we lived. We lived out in the suburbs. And I think we went to clubs to see films. And it would be the old projectionist and there would be a very definite interval. So you'd see the first spool and then you'd have to wait until they could wind the other spool on. But But it's an incredible sleight of hand for those 2 hours, which is generally what it is, that a space that is very plain generally can be transformed into something quite magical. And then you go out and you carry on with your life.
It is, I mean, part of why I was keen to start there, not just because we're in this spectacular room, a big thank you to Walter and Marion, Billy Griffin, but the is that the thing about cinema as an artistic opportunity to expose you to beauty is that it's a supremely communal act. It's building community around that appreciation of the artwork together. And to a certain extent, a writer's festival is taking the solitary act of writing a book, of reading a book, and remembering what kind of community comes out of that act. I've asked both of these wonderful authors to read from their latest works to get us started, because I think nothing will give you a better illustration of their treatment of beauty within their books. There's a quote from Christos on the at the top of the blurb on the back of the Australian edition of 7.5. Art is not only about rage and justice and politics. It's also about pleasure and joy. It's also about beauty. In a time of rage and confusion, I wanted to write about beauty. So, Christos, could you read us a passage?
I'm going to read a really short passage, which is part of the book. Is a book within a book within a book in 7.5. But this is the narrator recollecting a moment from childhood. The peninsula beaches of Melbourne are not dangerous. They are sea, not ocean. On hot summer weekends, a caravan would set off at dawn from our houses in the inner city, heading east to the coastal townships of Rosebud, Rye and Dramana. My mother and my Thea Irini would have been up late the night before, past midnight, preparing and baking the pies and roasted vegetables that would form part of our lunchtime meal at the beach. Even so, even having had so little sleep, it would be the women who would wake my brother and I in the morning, and we, shocked by the outrage of the early hour, would moan and close our eyes, demand to be left to sleep. My mother and aunt would have none of that. They would call us ungrateful animals, spoilt and soft, Australesi, Australians, not Greeks. Often my father or Theo Yorwa would enter, and one of them would lift me in his arms and the other would lift my brother, and they would tickle us and nuzzle our chests and our necks with their unshaven chins. And even though we didn't want to, we wanted to sleep, we demanded to sleep, we would both break out into delirious laughter. We were awake. I'm holding my father's hand. We're standing on the small brick wall he's built around the vegetable patch. The moon is high in the sky and the world is dark, yet I know it is not night, that something else is emerging. Listen, my father whispers. He points across the low corrugated tin rooftops of our neighbours' houses, points to what seems a grim black horizon. Listen, he repeats. The light softly creeps into being. First, a vague mist that seems to emanate from the bowels of the earth. Then that vapor deepens and becomes milky, and there are yellow and orange lines and splashes in the sky, and it is no longer black, and it is waves of lilac and plum-colored swirls. And then I see it, the first thin rays of the sun. And simultaneously, I understand my father's instruction. I'm not only seeing dawn, I am listening to it. But one by one, the birds of the city form a chorus. The emerging day has a boom to it. The world now feels replete with motion, and each movement has a sound. My father lifts me off the low wall and pushes me gently towards the outhouse. As I sit on the toilet in the darkness, thin sheets of light streaming through the planks, I hear the toot of a car horn. Theo Elias and Theo Diamando and my cousins have arrived to pick us up. When I push through the outhouse door, night has vanished. All is sun and light. This is the first dawn I remember.
Mm-hmm. 7.5 is a work of fiction with auto-fiction elements. You know, you have a protagonist who is a writer who can easily be overlaid over your own kind of identity, your own experience in life. But I'm interested in a book that takes as its heart being about beauty. It's also the work of yours that comes closest to feeling like memoir. How important was the personal and the truthful in writing about beauty?
That's a good question, Michael. I'm hesitating because, you know, I start with a quote by Jean Genet, And he was a writer that was so important to me when I was a young kid, but in my late teens, early 20s. And looking back at that young person who feels like a kid. When you read Janae, when you read, whether it's a thief's journal, reads like a memoir, the Lady of Our Flowers reads as autobiographical and first person, but you're also realizing that he's doing something else in there as well, which is to say, I am telling you that this is my story, but I'm also going to lie. And I think for me, yes, I was in that state with Seven and a Half. I started a novel, Sarah, called Resentment That Went Nowhere. You know, when you've been working on something and it's just read the words and go, this is just terrible. It's dead. It's dead. There's no life to it. And then I'll cut to the quick pandemic. Wayne and I, my partner and I, were away. We had to leave. We were celebrating our 35th anniversary. We only had 10 days in the end in the UK and came back to Australia, straight into quarantine. And I started writing this book on the second day. And I didn't know whether it was going to be a memoir. I didn't know whether I was going to write the story of Sweet Thing. I didn't. But I thought, I'm going to try and keep my muscles working, my intellectual and writing muscles, and see what emerges. So it is memoir, but it, for me, it's also about what I love about fiction.
Mm.
I don't want to.
We'll definitely come back to the personal nature of both assessment of beauty and depiction of beauty, but I'll bring you in here. If I can, Sarah. I think for many people in this room, I'm guessing, but if you think about particularly your kind of early lockdown periods during the pandemic and the things that gave you joy and comfort, still life might be pretty high on the list of things that got you through. Give it a show of hands, all the people who... It kind of embodied the very thing that I think we're all grieving for, the thing that we were losing, and not just the capacity to travel and to kind of go to these wonderful far-off places, but a sense of community and a sense of being around other people and the sheer joy that generates. And Still Life was this kind of phenomenal antidote to a moment. It was the thing that we were hungry for. Could you give us a reading from it to get us started?
So this is just after Ulysses and Evelyn, it's the start of the book, they've just discovered the painting and they've had the evening and they're traveling back. And the question that Ulysses asks is, so art, it's more important than people. Evelyn let out a long stream of smoke. She said, well, they go together. It's what we've always done. Left a mark on a cave or on a page. Showing who we are, sharing our view of the world, the life we're made to bear. Our turmoil is revealed in those painted faces, sometimes tenderly, sometimes grotesquely, but art becomes a mirror. All the symbolism and the paradox ours to interpret. And that's how it becomes part of us. And as counterpoint to our suffering, we have beauty. Oh, we like beauty, don't we? Something good on the eye cheers us, does something to us on a cellular level, makes us feel alive and enriched. Beautiful art opens our eyes to the beauty of the world, Ulysses. It repositions our sight and judgment, captures forever that which is fleeting. A meager stain in the corridors of history, that's all we are, a little mark of scuff. 150 years ago, Napoleon breathed the same air as we do now, and the battalion of time marches on. Art versus humanity is not the question, Ulysses. One doesn't exist without the other. Art is the antidote.
It's a beautiful mission statement for the book and a very kind of compelling thesis. Is it yours? Do you share it? Or is it a useful engine for the story and you have your doubts?
Most of that was mine. So, you know, Christos, you must know it, that sometimes when you're writing, you will write things so clearly on the page that it will always remain there, no matter what editing, and that was one of them. I added some bits with this lovely art historian called Stella, who I've talked about many times, but I added a little bit to bump it up with somebody who was incredibly knowledgeable. But that's how I was feeling, you know. There was a very conscious element to the book. You talk about lockdown. Lockdown wasn't on the horizon. The pandemic wasn't on the horizon. But what was on the horizon was this, was Brexit and what had happened to us as a country and the division and the hatred and the xenophobia. And it was incredibly palpable and brought to the surface things that had lain hidden for many, many years, this very right-wing rhetoric. And I sometimes think that there's only so much of that that you can keep reading about. Yes. There's only so much of that that you can bear without being recharged. And I think part of, you know, an answer to despair is our undying faith in the otherwise. And part of that is the need for joy and the need for beauty. And however you find that. But so that was what I was looking for. And I was looking for that in books as well. And so it became, I thought, well, I can't be alone with this, you know. So I wanted to write a pro-European novel, and I wanted to write a book about unity, and I wanted to write a book about joy as an act of resistance. Because the government was taking us so far the other way, I felt we needed that. So that was the consciousness and what would come into that. You know, it would include beauty. It would include where does art sit in society. It also includes opportunity and what happens to a predominantly working class family or found family when you give them opportunity, how they thrive. And also, as far as evening goes, the responsibility of wealth.
Joy as an act of rebellion is such a lovely concept. I could say you nearly jumped out of your seat there, Christos. That resonated?
Oh, no, it's because what you said, Sarah, is absolutely true. I mean, I was saying to you earlier that for me this book came out of, and this was before the pandemic, you know, that my previous novel, Damascus, was historical fiction, set it right at the beginning of the Christian era before it was Christian. And what I did, that was a really hard book. It took a long, long time. But I had a different joy there, which was that I had for the first year and a half of that process, I said to myself, I'm not going to read anything except something, books of theology and philosophy. I'm going to read the Jewish Bible and the New Testament. Reread the Quran. I'm just going to immerse myself in that world. And I felt like a student for the first time. And it's not that it's beauty as some kind of anodyne thing, right? Because part of what I discovered was, why did this faith grow? And it was because it was this horrific slave society. There was real ugliness. And then I come out of this process, and it is Brexit, and it is Trump, and it is partisanship, and it is anger, and it is Me Too, and Black Lives Matter, and these things matter, they're important, but there was only rage. And I just wanted to hold on to a notion of joy and a notion of beauty and a notion of love. And you use the word faith, and how do we talk about faith in a secular language? Mm. Because that, where is the memoir in 7.5? It's not as much the Christos Tsolkas memoir, it's the books I loved, the films I loved. They gave me exactly what Sarah was talking about. They were my guide. They gave me solace. They gave me faith. And I felt like I'd come out into a world where that was gone. It was just noise and rage and doom. Mm. That wasn't enough.
But the Christos in 7.5 not only has those things that anchor him and give him faith. But he has to actively shut out the world at the moment at which he's writing. He has to actively deny himself his phone, access to the internet, the act of reclaiming faith and beauty and joy almost requires him to live outside the historical moment.
Okay, I'll tell you, I was thinking about, because you and I are the same generation, so on the train, and I promise you, it gets that question.
Don't mind me.
I was on the train and I was listening to a playlist that I had. And I started doing that thing that we all do, right? You just shuffle. And I went, stop. Stay in. For some reason, you've put this song, it may have been 7 years ago, you've put it on this playlist that you've uploaded on your phone. It meant something to you. And it was the Pogues' Rainy Night in Soho, which I recall as a song. I have these vivid memories of dancing with friends I love to that album, to that period. But now listening to it as a 56-year-old man, there's a sadness to it too. And when McGowan sings, you know, it's a song about friendship for those of you who know it, right? Some of them fell into heaven and some of them fell into hell, and we've all experienced that. We've lost people, and some of them did fall to heaven and some fell to hell. And I just thought, that is beauty. That is actual real beauty. I will love this song till the end of time, my time. And I could have just skipped over it. So you need to make, I think we were all learning, all of us in this audience are learning how to do that again. Because we've, and I'm not being a Luddite, but I just think the technology makes it difficult at the moment to find that space.
I totally agree with you. We're saturated by so much information today, you know, and I know that many people would say, oh, you're middle-aged, you can't take it. I am middle-aged, and some of it I can't take. But also, do you know what? I've lived in a time whereby we had space for things. And I think that's what you're saying. You're making space. You didn't. You went back and you listened and you gave it space. And, you know, I was saying to Christos and Michael before that I read Christos's book on the plane. I came over last night and it was glorious. I don't watch films on the plane because I think I've explained I like a big screen and it makes me tired. And I couldn't be disturbed. And I had this book as my companion in a way that is so rare.
Yeah.
And it was my companion. He was my companion. And I felt privileged. And I drank every sentence and I smiled at it and I could breathe it in. And one of the things that I got from it, I was telling him, was its playfulness. And that, I have to tell you, in one of it, is a very rare quality with books and writers. You know, there's an earnestness, as if earnestness is going to make a book better, that sometimes in all art, if you bring in the joy word or the playfulness, then you can't be serious. I think it's the opposite. You know, I think a creative act that brings joy is actually, it gives well-being to society. And I think it's a very necessary thing. And, you know, and you need to give space. You need to give space to listen. You need to give space to read and not to be interrupted. And I think that's very hard today.
The kind of playfulness that can only be found in a talking parrot. That might just be Shakespeare. A sense of play is definitely something that permeates both your work. I wanted to ask, you said about Still Life that you wanted, amongst other things, to write a European novel in response to Brexit and with the timing. And I'm interested in, when writing about beauty and placing it in an artistic and literary tradition, no, a protagonist called Ulysses, E.M. Forster looming large over it, Shakespearean parrots, how you make those depictions of beauty not part of an exclusive club or an exclusive idea of beauty, but actually something that is open to readers coming at it from all different entry points?
Really, really good question. But the simplest way of saying that is that I believe it should all be inclusive.
Yeah.
You know, I had a career before this as an actor. my partner is a visual artist, so we've inhabited this space and we know how exclusive it can get. And I don't understand that. I don't want to exclude people. One of the things that I do is I do many, many drafts of a book in order to make it inclusive. And hopefully there are lots of different layers there. But at the end of the day, what I want is somebody to have a good read. And then maybe they might follow up on some elements, but you don't have to. And you might get something else out of it, but you don't have to do that. You know, I'm writing specifically about response, not about education.
I mean, I should be clear, I think you are phenomenally successful at it. I mean, I think it's one of the great achievements of the book is if you are a Forster fan, there are particular delights in here that reward that kind of conversation between the earlier work and your own, but it doesn't set up any kind of barrier, and I think that's an incredible achievement.
Thank you.
It is indeed. I mean, I think that thing you were saying, Sarah, and it's interesting because you have worked in other mediums as well. So it can be an elite club, mm-hmm. right? So part of it, is the work we do, right? There's a selfishness to fiction, right? I'm going to, you're doing it because this is the book you want to get to. This is what you want to write. This is the joy you want to experience. I've said to you, Michael, I always find nonfiction really harder because there's a responsibility to a fidelity to authentic truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a different kind of truth that's possible in fiction, but it's a bigger responsibility. I do feel that there's a play in fiction that I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose it as a writer and I don't want to lose it as a reader. But, you know, that breaking down the elite club is not only what Sarah and I are doing as writers, it's also what this festival is doing. Like, last night, a really good friend, Clem Basto, we did a reading at Essendon and Mooney Ponds Library, and I loved that. It's also getting out of the spaces of the inner city in Melbourne and kind of, because when we were young, when we were those young kids falling in love with 400 blows or whatever it was, you know, it wasn't necessarily that we had families that knew that world, right? Like, yeah. I just feel like that's a really important thing to keep hold of. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to write a book that is inaccessible to that world, but I also want to read a book that makes me go, oh, this is so beautiful, and it reminds me of why I want to kneel in front of Forster, you know, for the rest of my life.
Yeah, right?
Yes. Both of those things we can hold.
And I was also, you know, I was a kid or a young person, and I can't actually say that I would have felt comfortable coming to a literary festival, you know? And I don't want other people to feel that. I can't make you not feel that. But I want to do my best to say, you know, you don't have to do anything except turn up. No one's going to expect you to be anything different to who you are. But you might get some pleasure out of listening to something, right?
I was talking about this. So my partner, one thing we shared was when we were really young, one of our first kind of gateway drugs to reading was Agatha Christie. And he's got the whole, you know, the whole series. And that I just remember reading them and just saying, I would love, I mean, yeah, and we can talk about the sexism and the racism and the classism and but I would love to hear a session at the Melbourne Writers' Festival or the Edinburgh Writers' Festival that was on what Agatha Christie meant for us.
Yeah.
And I think that there would be an audience for that
in
a very, you know, that would open up the kind of conversations. Because what is beauty too? Sometimes the beauty of art is a solace. It's not the only thing, and it's not the only thing I want from art. But that's, do you know what I mean?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, it's what why I was so excited by this topic with the two of you today is that I don't think joy as rebellion, beauty as a kind of alternative to engaging with the anger and the politics of the day, I don't think either of you are advocates for beauty as escapism. You know, this is not beauty as a look over here, here's something that's going to comfort us and make us ignore the realities of humanity. It's quite the opposite, that through beauty, we can throw into stark relief some of the horrors, but we can also see them more truly, perhaps.
They live side by side. And I remember, if you go back to 9/11, that day, it was a beautiful day, and it was one of the last days of this incredible exhibition of Vermeer, at the National Portrait Gallery, and I went down there and I got my ticket straight away, and then I went to Soho, sat at Bar Italia, and I was waiting to go down there, and then it all unfolded. You know, it changed the world for us all. And then I had that moment of, I have this ticket, which at that time seemed absolutely superfluous. Like, what am I going to do with this ticket after witnessing this? But I went down and I saw these paintings of absolute beauty. And the horror still existed and the beauty still existed because that's what they do.
That's right.
And that's how we live our life. And we need that. We need those colors. And it's not escapism. It is about who we are on this, as I've said, on this cellular level, on what we see, what goes in here and what it does to our brain and then what it does for the rest of us. And in a way, it allows us to face horror. It allows us to face other things because we know that there is still this moment that exists for us. And I think beauty, there's something about beauty and gratitude that go together for me.
Yeah,
that if you can't be grateful for something, then you don't have it. And there is something about seeing it and the way it enters you and that it becomes yours. And then you can give thanks for it.
Absolutely. I'm trying to, as soon as you said that, I was thinking about one of the things, one of the great moments in Rhys, and I knew the book, but going back to the book of Job in the Jewish Bible, which is, I think, one of the great works of collective art. Like, it belongs to all of us. It's one of the great gifts of the Jewish tradition to the world. And that is, you know, that is a man who suffers, suffers and suffers and suffers, and why? And at the end, Job is grateful. And I think that's not an easy moment, right, to get to, but to be, I know how fucked the world is and that thought, but I wake up every morning, and this I learned through going back to those texts, to those words, and I say a thank you. And the Eucharist is that, and it doesn't matter whether you're an atheist or whatever your faith tradition, I'm just trying to explain that's, for me, that was such an important lesson to go, I am just going to say thank you that I am alive, that I have people I love, that I can read books I love, that I can watch films I love, and I can get angry 5 minutes later, but there is something in that graciousness.
Yep.
And you're absolutely right, I think. Yeah, beauty and gratefulness is very much connected for me.
Christos, arguably in 7.5, the most autobiographical speech in the book doesn't come from the Christos character, it comes from his friend Andrea, when she takes him to task and in pretty brutal terms says, you can't write beauty, that's not what you do. You know, you write raw, upsetting kind of glimpses of contemporary life that leave us all horrified. That's what you do.
But you can't do beauty.
I mean, well done for using your own book for therapy. I think congratulations, good choice. Do you believe that? Did you believe that? Is that the challenge you're trying to overcome in the book?
It is the challenge we... It never goes away, right? I think that sense of, there is faith and there is doubt. There is faith and there is doubt. There is actually an act of faith, an act of ego in writing a book, in performing, saying I will do this. But there's that doubt of, am I any good?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it ever vanishes, right? Mm-hmm. That's the only way I have found that I'm able to deal with it is to keep writing. So that task of, and keep going to the cinema and keep reading books and keep listening to music, but of sitting down, and when I'm working, I have a word limit. And, I've said this. There are days where you look at what you have written and go, this is the absolute rubbish. I'm embarrassed by that. I am no good. But that's the only way I found that I can continue, is because of those moments, that beautiful read you did and what you said, Sarah, that you found that Sometimes it happens where you go, I've got it.
Yeah.
I've got it. Mm-hmm. And they're not actually, they can be, they're really rare, those moments. But that's the faith that enables you to keep going within the doubt. That is the one of the experience of being an artist. You know that as an actor, you know that as a writer.
Yeah.
One of the great acts of joy and playfulness in still life is how beautifully plotted it is, how kind of that, the delicacy but also the kind of sense of purpose of the driver following these lives over so many years. Yeah. And that strikes me as artistically an act of faith. Do you go in knowing where it ends, or do you follow your characters? Is part of artistic pursuit having faith that you'll find the right path?
Yeah, I think so. I it's chaos. I don't plot anything. I have an ending though. So I like to have, certainly on the last three books, what I call a cinematic ending, because I want people to have that feeling. You know, when you used to leave the cinema and people would talk about the last line or that. So I have an ending and I see that ending and then I start somewhere. And it's as simple as that. And the rest is chaos. You know, and it's, I chip away at it and it's just taking away everything that it's not, everything that it's not. And then I move on and I don't really do what I would call a first draft. So my first draft will come maybe after 18 months. So it's a first draft that has been worked on many, many times. I don't go straight through. And I just build it up like that. But it is, you know, it's an act of faith. You start somewhere and you start with one character and you have a deadline and you think this is the one there, I'll be humiliated. And especially because this one, I was changing publishers. So, of course, I thought I'm going to be doubly humiliated and superstitious, like I should never have left. Like all of those things, I should never have left. So those things never go away, but you do it. And then in the meantime, you're reading books as well, and they're brilliant. And that is the act of faith, is that you know how it can be done. And that's what keeps you going, because how somebody has affected you, you want to affect other people.
Is it all right if I ask a question? I said before, you know, I realized it was an assumption about... Is it a similar act of faith in acting, or is there something different in the writing process?
I think there is always a similarity. So acting wise, you will have a moment with another actor, and you're speaking these words that are not your words, but they affect your heart and your mind and that. And it is the process. And the one thing that I always loved about acting was not performance, it was rehearsal. You know, and I always said it, that if you're on stage, if you were acting for the stage and you had these nighttime rehearsals, evening rehearsals, and I still think they're the magic, where the lights are low, everybody's quiet, and you're working it out with somebody, and something happens that will never happen again. And it probably will never be repeated, but those are the moments. And those are the moments, because of course it's oral, it's not being written down and it's in the moment. Those are the same moments that we were talking about.
Yes.
That we will have that little moment of burst of transcendency where you might get four lines down that actually you can say are pretty good and that will remain. So those are the two sparks that happen. But I think I don't have it so much. You know, I didn't really do much good work in theatre or in acting. Oh, really? So, no, I really didn't. So I didn't have too much.
Well, Sarah, we have a video of it so that we can assess your work.
Oh, God.
So good about rehearsals, really. I don't have, I've worked in theatre and I love it. I don't have that I really have to try hard as a playwright. I don't have that instinctive gift. You know, I think there are gifts that we have, but I fell in love with the rehearsal process, and I didn't have a background where theatre was part of my life, and it has been invaluable. I've talked about this before, but actually learning from actors as a writer, that I think that actually transformed a period of my writing, because
being in that space, yes, where you go, you work on it and you work on it and you work on it and you work on it, and suddenly, yes, you've got a line, you've got a, you know, and it comes from that collaboration between the writer and the performer. And also those exercises, those, how do you embody a different kind of character? There's a beauty there, right?
Yeah.
And I started using it in my practice.
Yeah.
To actually, it's not no longer just the blank page in myself, but to actually go, how does she sit?
Mm-hmm.
How does she move? How does she cry? How does she, you know, those are gifts that actors give you.
They do. Actors have great instinct as well. You know, and I think I would imagine if you were in a reading or in a rehearsal space that you might have an emotional scene and these two actors are coming together and it's not that last two sentences isn't quite right. You can feel it because the actor's instinct has completely taken over and they're taking you, and you just haven't done the line. But then you will get it because they've completely brought you to where you need to be.
One of the most beautiful moments I've ever had in my life, so talking about beauty, was the first play I was involved in. It was called Who's Afraid of a Working Class? There was a great company here in Melbourne called Melbourne Workers Theatre. I'd written a monologue that was really angry. It was a young working class boy, full of venom and spite, and it was nearly there, but it wasn't quite there. And then I was asked, and you know, an actor taught me to do this: ask the actor questions in their character. And was asking questions, and then I said, "What's your favourite film?" And Bruce said, "Wizard of Oz." And it was just it was an instinct, right? And I thought, "That's beautiful. I know exactly how I'm going to write him now."
Yeah.
That he's angry and furious, and you will be scared if you're on the tram with him, and you will be scared if you see him in the street. But I know his favourite film is Wizard of Oz, and that is beautiful.
It is, yeah. And it changes everything.
Yeah, exactly, and that was an actor's gift.
Yeah.
In a second, you're going to get to ask questions of these two. There'll be microphones in the two aisles at a couple of different levels. I do have to ask you to make your way to the microphone rather than it coming to you, just for COVID safety and all of that. But if you make your way there and queue up, you'll get a chance to ask a question. I'm not surprised to hear you both talk about rehearsals, about performance, as a kind of singular moment of creative fulfilment, because I think as well as ideas of joy and beauty that we could talk about today in both your work, actually joy and beauty are most embodied in both works by human connection and by love. You know, they're both ultimately love stories at their heart, and while there are other factors, whether it is art or place or food or memory or the natural world where beauty is found in these books, it is most deeply rooted in human connection and in love. Is that, do you think that's inevitably a part of anything you're going to write, Sarah?
Yes.
Good.
No, I do. You know, that in the epigraph, there's, what is it? Two people pulling each other into salvation is the only story I want to tell, or forced to quote, you know, and I feel that, you know, it's what we do. I think those are the quotes. Who is it? Eric Fromm says the only answer to being human is love, and therein lies sanity. You know, it's, and I think we, when we use the word love, we sometimes just think it's about attractiveness and who's doing what. We don't look at the word or dissect the word about compassion and dignity, and grace and respect and empathy and all those beautiful colours that lie within that word and the stories that then can kind of move out from that. I only write love stories. I see that. I think they're unconventional. I hope they're unconventional. And I hope I continue to write as unconventionally as possible in the possibilities of what those relationships can be. But I love people. And I am an introvert. And what lockdown showed me more than ever was how much I need people. You know, even in my solitude, and in my quietness, and in those awkward times that I've had so many of. Yeah, I need people. And not just the people who I know and love, but just those connections. So, yeah, I hope to continue.
Christos?
I mean, love to me is it's central, but, you know, that thank you, that Efkharish thought that I make every morning is because I have been very fortunate to have known love in family. I've been very fortunate to know love in Wayne. I've been very fortunate to know love in my friends. I am very fortunate, and actually I do love the world. One of the things that I, in 7.5 for me was, I have to be careful here because it sounds like an insult, and I don't mean it as an insult. I discovered, I think through Damascus, and the joy and pleasure in this book is about, I'm not Protestant. And that saying that is not, I actually have a great respect for the Protestant tradition, really do, but I'm not that, and I love the world. And sometimes a lot of the current political language feels like a Puritan dismissal of the world, you know. And I get why people are angry, and I'm furious about what we're doing to the planet. But I actually love this. I love people. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right, Sarah. Just on the tram coming in, there was a group of young kids, and they were mucking around, and they were like from everywhere, every corner of the globe, but they were Australian, and they were so alive. And I just thought, I'm really glad to be on this carriage in this moment in time, even if we're going to the road to nowhere.
Right?
It's not the road to nowhere, it's the number 86 train.
It was actually the Mernda line, but
okay. We might bring the house lights up a bit so that I can see if anyone is taking us up on the offer of questions. Don't be shy. This is your only chance, apart from the silent queue. I'm being signaled. Oh, or you can put your hand up and we'll get a microphone to you, because apparently COVID's over, which is good news. You heard it here first. So wave your hand around if you have a question, and we will get to you. Is there one down here that I missed? Yes, one just here.
Thanks so much for this, guys. I've got a question for you, Christos. So John Keats once wrote that beauty is truth, truth is beauty, that's all you need to know. And you sort of discussed that in your book 7.5, whilst there exists an autobiographical element of truth, there is also an understanding of falsehood or lying. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on whether you think there's an intrinsic link between truth and beauty.
It is a beautiful sentiment, and I think that there is a truth, but I don't think it's the only truth. I hope I'm not being deliberately obscure there. I don't know if you do the same thing, Sarah, like I've got a file that's been going on for years where I collect quotes from writers, and that's one of them. And often I look at those quotes and go, they're so beautiful, and they get to a truth, but there is... and probably because of queerness for me, from really, and being told that the books I loved and the films I loved were filthy or disgusting, or that I also think there's a truth in the scandalous, and actually a truth in the ugly as well. And so, does that make sense? That it's like a holding of both there for me, you know, that.
Not only does it make sense, but it actually brings me to something I wanted to ask both of you, which is it strikes me that the idea of joy as rebellion is a historically very queer concept, you know, that actually part of queer survival, queer resistance had to be about joy in the face of that joy being denied in many different ways. How important is queerness in your understanding of beauty and the kind of artistic beauty you want to write about?
I don't think, is it conscious? I am queer, so it's just what I write. I think what happened with this book was understanding my freedom and how lucky I am to be able to write what I want to write, especially with the Forster section. That he was a man who I believe never really wrote the fiction that he wanted to. He wanted to write a gay fiction. And Maurice, yes, but I don't think it's one of his best, and it was originally written before he had lost his virginity. So one can question, was it really where he wanted to go with that book? It was published after he died. So I wanted, so the section at the end where Evelyn is having the best sex of her life with the young maid and she meets Forster, who is closeted, it was really the contrast of where we are today and a celebration and a thank you to him, because all his books have a queerness, especially A Room with a View is so queer.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, but I wanted to say thank you and I want to carry on, and this is where we are today and how fortunate that I am that I can write this and I'm not going to be arrested or I'm not going to be taken out from where I'm writing or stoned or, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's part of it and it's a joy to be able to write that.
But also it seems to me that his, I think that's a really lovely idea, it seems to me Forster's queerness in A Room with a View in particular comes back to that thing we were talking about around who gets to own an experience of beauty, who gets to be the one to identify it, to talk about it, to connect with it. Is that belongs to some people and not to others?
Absolutely. It's totally what he's talking about. It's like who has the right to comment on art and who has it, you know, and it's that is his, the duplicity of everything he writes. It's the light and the dark and the sacred and the profane and the educated versus the not and the life of the spirit versus, you know, life of the body. And that, I think, all comes back to his, he was a humanist and was until his death, and it was what was important was the interconnectedness of it all, but also the connection of being human, the light and dark of being human, you know, and he was wanting to explore that. And he wanted it to be inclusive. That's why he's parodying and it's a satire and he's shining the light on English society, because it was just nonsense to him.
Mm. That divide of the mind and the body, I mean, so much of the beauty in Seven and a Half is about trying to find words for inarticulate beauty, particularly in the stuff of memory, you know, and the ways in which a smell, a kind of glimpse of something can evoke, you know, such powerful personal connections.
I mean, I think to the original question and to that second question you're asking, I'm very, for me, kind of conscious of the fundamental importance of kind of those queer writings in who I am, those, that queer cinema, that queer expression. But I would open it up to the word, the erotic, you know, to say that there are also, you know, the writers of erotic cinema. You know, I was a very young person when I first saw Bertolucci's The Conformists the first time, and the erotics of that screen experience, what cinema could do, that actually beauty could move your body into and it felt like a promise, even though it's I mean, for people who don't know the film, it's set in fascist Italy. It's a really difficult film, but it is one of the most sumptuous films I've ever seen. And it gave me I think to your question, truth is beauty, or beauty is truth there. Mm. But there is there is something in the response to the sensual and the erotic that I think is important to what we do, and I worry that's being a little lost at the moment. Maybe for good reason, you know, I understand the arguments around safety, but I love the risk of what I experience watching that film at a young age. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that I was exposed to that stuff. I think that's a conversation that you can't sum up in a minute. Mm-hmm. We need to sit down over a drink
and lovely. Talk
about it. Lock the doors.
But yes, the erotic is really has been pivotal for me in terms of essential and what we do as writers. I don't want to lose the ability to write the sensual. Mm-hmm.
There's a question just here, just to your left.
Thank you. My question is more for Sarah. Is there a version of your novel that could have taken place anywhere else but Florence?
Possibly, but I hesitate, and I tell you why. Because I came to, or the story met me. That's probably a better bit. The story met me in Florence, and it was all centered around the flood of 1966, which I didn't know about, which was devastating, you know, for the written patrimony. 6 million books ruined. 14,000 movable artworks, you know, we could go on. That wasn't the exact story. It was about the young men and women predominantly who came from all over the world, mainly Europe, to clean up the city. And that was the love affair. And I suppose that would tie up with this whole notion of beauty, that these young people were the children of the war generation. So that was their mission, that they felt a need to travel to. It was the part of stabilizing Europe, bringing peace to Europe, bringing prosperity to Europe, bringing healing to Europe, and that they felt that it was worthwhile to travel to this city, to camp out in railway carriages, to huddle around braziers in the freezing cold, to be in the basement of a library and up to their knees in water and chilling mud, to hand what was once a book to the next person, the next person, the next person, because there was worth in that. And there was beauty in that gesture. And you see the photographs if you look them up. And this was the 60s, these young kids, and they're tired and they're covered in mud and they're swapping bottles of wine between each other and they're glazed. And you know this one is falling in love with this one because you can see it. And so could it have happened anywhere else? It would have needed all of those circumstances to have happened somewhere else. And so for me, it met me there and I wasn't anywhere else.
That's a pretty lovely note, I think, to end things on. I know that you will all join me in thanking these two extraordinary writers. They will be signing books.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
This session has been made possible thanks to the support of the Faculty of Arts at the University of Melbourne. The Readings Bookshop in the foyer is selling all the books by these two authors, so you can get the ones you haven't read, plug the gaps in your collection. There is much beauty to be had there. Enjoy the rest of the festival. Thank you and goodbye. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This series was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which we work. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders past and present. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers' Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.